Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast Duty of Care, a podcast from the Center for the Just City at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, a center dedicated to pursuing social justice through the lens of sustainable urban development. I am Hugo Lopez, and together with Roberto Rocco, we produced and edit this podcast. Today we have with us Titus Kalocki from FES, the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung for Social Democracy.
So welcome, Titus, to our podcast. Could you tell us who you are and what do you do?
Yes, my name is Titus Kalocki. I'm from Kenya. I work as a program coordinator at the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, or FES, Kenya office, leading the work on just cities, young leadership and politics. But apart from that, I am very passionate about achieving social justice, about participating in political processes that are democratic. And I'm also a married man, a father of two. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, hoping to build a better future for them.
Yeah. That puts things into perspective. And can you tell us about the work of FES? What does FES stand for and what do you do?
Yes, FES globally is very much concerned about promoting democracy, social justice, peace and security. In the context of Kenya, we have been since 60 years ago working on these topics by supporting local partners drawn from trade unions, civil society, political parties, and sometimes progressive elements of the private sector. We work in partnership with them to conceptualize ideas on how we could make interventions that result in lasting both community and global solutions.
And who supports FES? Who is behind it?
So FES is a foundation that is closely affiliated to the Social Democratic Party of Germany. And it is through the representation of the party in the parliament, depending on the number of MPs they have, that we get a share of funds by German taxpayers through the BMZ or the Foreign Development Office. So it's fully funded by the taxpayer as part of the German structure of supporting political foundations.
And why would Germany want to support democracy in other places? Why is it important?
Yes, I think this is coming in the context of FES from historical lessons, because Friedrich Ebert was the first democratically elected president of Germany after the fall of the previous system, which was more of monarchy. And because of the struggles of Friedrich Ebert and the Social Democratic Party, especially through supporting labor unions to fight for more worker representation in political process, for more worker benefits in the economic system, then democracy was the only guarantee. And because this worked for them, they thought then later they would spread this across the globe, especially to guarantee the lower classes representation, but also redistribution of wealth gets to them.
Perfect. FES. I think FES is it's very concerned about justice, and you guys use the concept of just city. And I'm interested to know what are the key principles that you use. What is the just city for you guys at FES?
Yes, I think I would want to say the just city idea, even though we borrowed it from mainly the Harvard conceptualization of Dr. Susan Fernstein. She had her own principles, democracy, equity, and I forget the third one. But in our context, when we looked at where do we find ourselves as a Kenyan nation, when we look at both the economic and the social factors that affect a majority of people, we realize that there's a lot of injustice, especially because there has been poor redistribution of wealth by investing in public goods and services. And therefore, the just city is conceptualized along four principles in Kenya. And these are dignity as the first one. Why? Because we looked at the African values and how the Kenyan community is grounded. And we realized that there is always a strive to dignify everybody in the society, whether you're rich or poor. You would have, for example, your own space to build your own home, even if it's a mud hut. You would not be prevented from attending social functions that involve the whole community. You could have your say, and you could receive justice if you needed it. And therefore, this, when we look even broadly at the Utu philosophy or Ubuntu philosophy, which means you are because I am, it means that nobody should ever be treated as an individual who is separate from society.
Separate from the community, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And therefore, this brings a certain level of dignity, which we thought is very important for just cities. Apart from it being a part of the UN Universal Declaration of Rights, which also demands dignity for everybody. And we say that should be our first principle. Uh-huh. Anything that a city does must dignify its residents. The second one is equity and diversity. This comes out of the recognition that different members of the community or urban areas or cities have different needs. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how we respond to them should be according to their needs and not just give one solution for all. And therefore, we think if then you look at the diversity of needs and you respond to them well, then you will achieve equity. The third one is rights and responsibilities. And in this, we are grounded in the Kenyan constitution that has guaranteed, for example, public goods and services under Article 43. These are rights, the right to housing, health, education, public transport that have been guaranteed to the people. But also it demands that the people participate in governance processes. And therefore, this is a responsibility. And we thought a balance must be struck between demanding for rights, but also the citizens taking their responsibilities seriously and doing them. And finally, democracy. This is very important because for us, and especially the discourse we have had in Africa in post-colonial time, there has been a huge insistence on good governance. The World Bank pushes good governance. But for us, we were not satisfied that good governance alone is adequate, because you can have good governance that is autocratic. When we look, for example, at, let's say, one of the most praised cities in Africa, Kigali in Rwanda. Yes, there is good governance there. It functions well, but we don't see a lot of space for democratic participation, for people to give their ideas to shape urbanization processes. And therefore, democracy for us is a way to approach the governance issues in urban areas.
So a lot of people have criticized governance as indeed a concept pushed by the World Bank and other institutions. Mm-hmm. To signify neoliberal governance, right, rather than democratic governance. So is this something that plays a role in your thinking?
Yes, this is very much important because FES in its entirety pushes for democracy, mm-hmm. for social justice to be achieved through democratic means and not through benevolent dictatorship or authoritarian.
Or through charity, for example.
Yes, yes. So it's very key, but also because the Kenyan constitution demands that there must be public participation in all governance processes. So it's also a way of us helping Kenya realize its aspirations.
Well, you know that in the West, I think the issue of participation runs into several problems or several challenges. And one of them being that people don't have time to participate. And I think that's an important issue when we talk about how our workers are, you know, they are exhausted into not participating, right? How do you see that? How to promote participation among people who don't have time to participate? How do you feel about those things?
Yeah, the first thing we realized was it's hard to have democracy on an empty stomach. Mm-hmm. Because democracy requires participation, mm-hmm. and participation requires time and resources. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our population in Kenya are struggling to survive. They are working to have a meal at the end of the day. They are 75% and above are informally employed. This means they don't have predictable income, they have no social protection. What they sell today is what they eat, so they have to put in more time. They may not have time for public participation. On the other hand, the government doesn't have enough resources to be able to hold or facilitate consultative meetings with everybody in society. It's almost impossible. So for us, we see a bridge by leveraging technology between government and the people to make public participation not to be bound in physical presence, so that people can participate at a self-paced mm-hmm. Way without being required to be available physically, but also in a more meaningful way, because participation without prior information leads to tokenism or just rubber stamping of ideas. And therefore, we have been struggling with this for a long time. We have experimented a bit with technology to showcase to governments that it's possible to enable people to participate more. But it is an ongoing problem that we are still working on solutions.
Yeah, I think a few philosophers of education would say that you need to educate people so that they can participate in a more meaningful way, right? So you need to inform, educate, and so on. How do you feel about those things?
I think they mm-hmm. they are very much correct, because in our experience, we worked a lot with our partners to first create awareness before then we could enable these people to engage, for example, with the urban authorities. But on the other hand, there is always this dilemma. Are people marginalized because they don't receive these public goods and services? Or is it because the public goods and services are designed in a way from the beginning that already marginalizes them? So sometimes you get into a problem where we wonder, if you don't bring the person to the platform of participation, even if they are not educated, would they be justified to be there? Or you say they are not educated, so you don't bring them to the platform. And this dilemma is one where we say we cannot prioritize and say only those who are educated can meaningfully participate. Maybe we also need to bring them to the participation, and then we can learn where do they need to be educated.
Or enlarge the ways by which people participate so that it includes people who are not formally educated. And,
yes, I think that's the gist of it. Uh-huh. How do you make participation? Yes, it requires a level of information, but at the same time that requirement does not exclude some underprivileged members of society.
Absolutely.
FES is the oldest political foundation in Germany, with a rich tradition in social democracy dating back to its birth in 1925. The foundation owes its formation and its mission to the political legacy of its namesake Friedrich Ebert, the first democratically elected German president. The work of FES focuses on the core ideas and values of social democracy: freedom, justice, and solidarity. FES is a non-profit institution that organizes their work autonomously and independently. Titus Kalocki is program coordinator at FES Kenya office, where he leads the Just City program, which engages the concept of a social and inclusive just city to facilitate innovative discussions among political decision makers, civil society representatives, and others on issues such as affordable housing, fair and clean public transport, and meaningful civic engagement in urban spaces. Titus is currently following a master's in public administration at the University of Nairobi, where he conducts research on factors affecting inclusive access to urban service delivery in Kenya. Titus is interested in assessing inclusiveness, public participation, government information and services, and urban management systems that enable urban service delivery. In the second part of the interview, we continue to talk about Titus' work at FES and ideas on how to achieve the Just City.
I'd like to go back to something you said before about the creation of public goods and, you know, that public goods are expressed in the Constitution of Kenya. Mm-hmm. And then there is a little bit of a conundrum there, because you also said a large percentage of the population lives, you know, day to day, and they are really struggling to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And many of them work informally, which gives the government very little tax base to create these public goods. Mm-hmm. And I think that taps into the discourse of poverty in Africa. Mm-hmm. How do you see the ability of African governments to create public goods and their willingness to do so? How do you see that?
I think, first of all, it has to be dealt from an attitude and mindset level. Because before this neoliberal movement by Thatcher and is it Reagan, many of the colonial institutions that were in Africa were actually providing at least a good level to urban residents of public goods and services. In Kenya, we had public transport. In the past, buses that were bought by government, fares that were subsidized by government to make them affordable. Many of the older generations of the 80s, 70s did have access to proper water, sanitation. But then at some point, African governments seem to have shifted to outsource this provision or the funding for this to development partners. And therefore you see increasingly, instead of governments utilizing the resources they have to provide what they can, they outsource this to the World Banks, to the donors, to come and do water. And slowly this interfered with the expectation of the people from the government. So many people stopped to demand this kind of public goods and services from the government, and the government used the interventions of donors and development partners to escape its responsibility. But yes, there is a budgetary problem because of a very small tax bases. This would require African governments to learn how to deal with informality. I think the previous approach of formalizing everybody is not working well. Maybe there is a need to understand more on how to deal with the informality to bring them into the tax bracket, but also how do you be accountable to them to motivate them to cooperate? Because informality in itself is caused by the absence of the provision of these goods. So these people are surviving despite the government being there. And therefore, sometimes they say, we don't want the government to come interfere. After all, you never gave us a place to trade. You didn't connect us with electricity, water, and sewerage. We have done all this on our own.
So it seems to be a vicious circle,
yeah.
And in which the government doesn't provide people grow accustomed to that lack of provision, and they don't expect the government to provide.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that in the past, there were services and services were being provided,
mm-hmm.
which makes me think that maybe these ideas are largely ideological. They come from ideologies of, minimum state and things like that. And, There is a need for a transformation of mentalities and there's a need for transformative change.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you guys have a strategy to promote that.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us more about this strategy?
Yeah, we call it transformative change making. And this is something that was piloted in Asia by a colleague called Mark Zaxa, who kind of created the conceptual framework and the guide on how to do it. And the idea is, it's not how do we conceptualize political change or societal change. So initially, as FES, we thought people are willing to do good things, to make good changes happen. They just don't have adequate information on how. And therefore, we invested in creating awareness, capacity building, and some policy recommendations. But still, many years now, as I said, 60 years in Kenya next year for FES, these changes have not yet taken place. And therefore, the idea is to reconceptualize how do we expect societal change to happen. Into that, it is not that people are not willing, it is not that they don't know, it's not a lack of policies, it's more about a societal struggle between those who are benefiting now from the situation, the status quo, and those who want change. And once we recognize this, then we ask ourselves, why are the status quo people dominant? It is because their vision, their narrative, is the one that society has accepted as the norm. So, for example, if the government expects you to pay taxes, but it's not accountable in providing public goods and services, over time, people stop expecting. And this becomes like common sense in like, yeah, it's Africa, like what they say, this is Africa, you know, and people are dominated by this narrative of the government is inefficient, it will never work, and they then lose or give up hope. But if you were to share an alternative vision that, okay, maybe the situation is like this, but it is possible to have a much more fairer future, then you could encourage these people who've lost hope to start to recalculate how do they see themselves and their interests in that new great future that is just and fair. And once they're able to do that, then they are willing to come out of their hard-taken positions or what they think is common sense to be more engaging and open to discuss then how do we get to this better future. And that's the three steps of that process. So an alternative vision to help the actors to recalculate their interests and get out of their defensive positions. The second is to build a narrative that explains how do we get to this better future. And in this, you have to put in research, you have to build evidence, because nobody will just believe you on the face of it. You have to encourage dialogue amongst what we call non-traditional allies.
Mm-hmm.
For example, civil society is always pointing fingers at the government or the private sector. So how do you bring them to a level where they can start to discuss this future based on evidence? And finally, then you have to make at least an example of one of those ideas for the future by doing a small project, what we call a catalytic project, because they say seeing is believing. And if this works, then hopefully these three actors, the civil society, the government and the private sector could scale this up.
And in another talk, in another class that you gave us, you mentioned the fence sitters,
mm-hmm.
those people who are between the status quo and between transformative change. And what is the importance of bringing them in, and how do you do that?
Yes, the fence sitters, especially in our experience, are drawn from the professional classes and the private sector. Because for them, they are very pragmatic and objective.
Mm-hmm.
They try to stay away from the politics of the day. They want to do things in an orderly manner. Unfortunately, the government and the corporate world does have a lot of influence on them, because they speak on the language of doing plans, projects, but also on making profit and progress. And the questions of social justice, which complicate this process further, does not really draw them, because also the civil society efforts are not meant in a way to understand the fence sitters in many times, but more of antagonistic, you know, accuse. And therefore, they tend to lean towards government and private sector. So the way to influence these fence sitters would be to help them unpack and discuss the issues of justice, social justice, and have a honest discussion on how pragmatic can it be within their world for them. And that is why they are so important, because they can swing either side. They are more of like independent actors, but they can support whichever side that makes more sense to them, especially because of this pragmatist and approach that they have.
And I think it's pretty clear that the vision that you are articulating, this vision that you want all these actors to work towards, is a vision connected to dignity, to human dignity. But could you tell us more, and how would you explain that vision to, you know, to a citizen? What is this future we are looking for?
Yeah, in the context of the Just City, it's simple. We want the vision to be that cities and urban areas are more citizen-centered than business-centered. So this is what makes our vision alternative, because we believe that the current visions, for example, the Kenya Vision 2030, the AU Agenda 2063, leans more on productivity, profitability, efficiency, you know, security, the things that are more business friendly, but does not adequately address the issues of participation, inclusivity, provision of public goods and services, which are more citizen-centered. So our vision is to drive a majority of population to also care about the citizen-centered vision and support it in the long term.
Yeah, that's a big paradigm shift, right, from what we have had before, where everything is centered on growth, on productivity, efficiency, and so on. And this also speaks to the idea of the smart city, right? How the smart city also appeals to those ideas and pursues productivity and efficiency. And I heard you being quite very critical of the idea of the smart city. Could you tell us more about it?
Yeah, this is also based on our experience. In Kenya, I mentioned we had a Kenya Vision 2030, which is now only 7 years remaining to achieve, but I think it's only achieved like 30%. And in it, we had what we call flagship projects. And one of these is the Konza Technopolis. So we were going to build a new city just next to the capital city to be the embodiment of this new future of high efficiency, security, productivity, leaping into the 21st century as a leader in technology and in the world. And it's even touted as it was supposed to be the Silicon Savannah of East Africa. But at the same time, when up to now they've only built maybe one building and it's still a big land, but the whole idea was it's only a city for those who can afford to live there. So we didn't see the identity or the belonging of the common or the lower classes, the people who cannot do white collar jobs, the people who are not technologically oriented. We didn't see them there. Even the idea of this city, because it's based on the smart city, was not out of a collective discussion of Kenyans. It was a consultant, McKinsey, and the government bureaucrats coming up with this. So it's not owned by the people. And the underlying thing of smart cities is that they are globally oriented. They want to attract global capital, global technology, sometimes at the expense of the local needs and the local rights. So for us, we are not fully against the smart city. We are against its overemphasis of efficiency, security, centralized control, because this goes against decentralized control, which would allow for participation of people to shape how these cities become. It goes against guaranteeing privacy of how data is used, of how people are planned for. It goes against almost self-determination of the people from bottom up, because it's very heavy on top down. And therefore, we see it as the opposite, but we still believe along the way, you can have a smart and just city.
Yeah.
Titus is currently following a master's in public administration at the University of Nairobi, where he conducts research on factors affecting inclusive access to urban service delivery in Kenya. Titus is interested in assessing inclusiveness, public participation, government information and services, and urban management systems that enable urban service delivery. Titus spoke to us during the 9th edition of the Summer School Planning and Design for the Just City, which we organize at TU Delft every July, and to which he contributed. During its 9 years of existence, the Summer School has hosted more than 600 students from quite literally all over the world. You can learn more about the school at www.summerschooltudelft.org. Now, let's hear to Titus.
And it seems that this smart city that is sold to us by big corporations overlooks those who are the urban invisible, so to speak, right? And could you tell us more about these urban invisibles? How do you define them?
Yeah, so the Urban Invisibles is a term that the FES uses to define those people who are ignored in urban plans and projects. And this, in our context, include the urban poor. This is because of the informality they live in. The informality happens because there are no plans for them and projects for them. They include women, children, elderly, and people living with disability. And this is because these are the people who find it hard to engage in the city, to move around in the city. Whenever there are town halls, for example, where people need to discuss a future project of the city, it might be held in a building that does not have accessibility for somebody with a wheelchair. So they will not attend.
Or where people don't feel welcome.
So the invisibility comes first from them not being recognized as existing. And this is why we talk of the equity and diversity. But the second one is because they're not recognized, then their voice in shaping urbanization processes is missing. And therefore, we try to facilitate them by first recognizing them, finding out where they are, mapping them and their interests, and then facilitating them to access political decision-making processes that are very huge impacts on the kind of public goods and services they receive.
As you mentioned, you were elaborating a tool to also reach like those urban invisibles, as you say. Can I ask, like, how is this going? Can you tell more, like, how this tool is working on the ground for those people?
So in the Kenyan context, we are working closely with the newest city in Kenya called Nakuru. They just got their charter December 2021. And they are very young, but they're also a bit progressive. And in the beginning, when we talked to them about implementing the principles, they embraced this. And we started by hosting urban stakeholders dialogues. Mm-hmm. But in the view of the city, they were looking for experts, you know, businessmen. For them, stakeholders are, you know, professionals, you know, people who know what they are talking about. And these are the people they wanted to hear from to inform their policy. But then we tried to tell them, look, it is also possible for those who you don't consider as stakeholders. Already the invisibility was there because the city was not seeing these people in the informal settlements as part of stakeholders.
As valid stakeholders.
Yeah. And therefore, we were able to entice them to agree to pilot one of the most sensitive areas of urbanization, which is planning. Planning is mainly expert-led in many instances. Mm-hmm. And we were able to leverage a technological tool that simplifies the planning process by taking what is physically seen into a 3D environment and being a drag and drop exercise. Even those in the informal settlements can participate in. And by taking this pilot project to a specific informal settlement, we were able first to demystify that these people lack competencies. Because after all, many of them are already online. They use WhatsApp, Facebook, and all that. So that notion was disabused. And secondly, that they don't have the capacity. And this was disabused because they donated a church to be the space where we will set up for a co-design campaign. And the youth were able to be trained how to use the tool, and they were able then to help the rest of the residents to come and plan their settlement based on their vision of how they would want it to look like. And in the end, the planners of the city said, the plan that came out was fairly well grounded and would be easily integrated into the bigger city plans. So this was something to prove that it is possible to have the urban invisible participate as long as you facilitate them with either knowledge, technology, and even platforms.
And that's great. As long as we recognize that they exist.
They exist, right? Yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
We wanted to ask you, Titus, about the socially just public transport working group. So we know that you are part of two working groups, of the spatial justice, and the second one is the socially just public transport. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. As I said, the only way to prove the just city in action is to actually to try to apply this idea on a real situation on the ground. And because our focus is on public goods, we chose public transport as one, as an entry point, because most of the urban Kenyans rely on public transport to move around. But at the same time, we don't really have a public transport. What we have is private vehicles that carry the public. We have zero to minimal investment by governments in this public transport in a way that would probably, you know, subsidize, improve it. And therefore, the people are left to the mercy of profiteers. So it was also a very political issue. We knew that many people want it addressed, but they just haven't found how. And for us, it was by forming a working group that is composed of academia, media, urban built environment professionals, some civil society, but also grassroots organizations that represent urban invisibles. And the idea for this working group was to bring like 10 to 15 individuals who could sit down and ask themselves, what would a socially just public transport look like? And then start to build evidence and to do research into some of the pathways that could lead Kenya to achieving a socially just public transport. And it is through this process, then they said, this is how we can measure or we can define a socially just public transport. And therefore, they came up with five pillars. They call them pillars because they are drawn from the just city principles, but they go a bit deeper. And therefore, they say the first thing, it must be accessible because this is not the current situation. Yes, you can have a fancy ride on a train, but where you get dropped off, going to your home is another nightmare. There's no like last mile connection. It has to be accessible, even to those with disabilities. We don't have specially designed public transport that accommodates them. Secondly, it has to be affordable. This is a huge problem in Kenya because a simple issue like rains can dramatically change the pricing in a route. So what you pay in the morning is not guaranteed is what you'll pay in the evening. So there has to be a regulation kind of that makes this public transport affordable. Either it's subsidized or it's regulation of fares. The third one was it must be sustainable because we recognize that public transport in our context is, I think, the second greatest emitter of carbon, and there we have a huge opportunity in just transition to e-mobility and others to really deal with the issue of sustainability. But they also looked at human rights because, as I mentioned, public transport is guaranteed under Article 43 of our Constitution as a right. So how do they unpack this and make and advise governments on how to enable this right to be realized. But finally, they also looked at equity and diversity, which is a principle of the Just City, because public transport needs are, they vary depending on the communities you want to serve. For example, in Nairobi, women, for example, have to travel in some specific time frame because of the fear of sexual harassment. And therefore, when you're providing public transport, you would need to think about how do you empower women and cater for their needs to be able to travel safely at any time of the day. And this is what the working group bases its approach on.
Yeah, it makes me think that you really need to converse with government, right, to advise them. And how open or how, what are your avenues into advising the government and, you know, forming policy for public transportation in Kenya?
Yeah. So the main thing is we always look for an entry point that will not make the government alarmed or defensive.
Mm-hmm.
So in this, we identify projects they are doing or they are planning to do, and we plug in by telling them, okay, we know, for example, in Nairobi, they were building a new bus terminus, a bus park. And we told them, okay, we know you are doing this, but have you tried to think of it through a socially just lens? They have the funding already from the World Bank. They have already done the designs with the expert designers. They have even broken ground. And so the idea was to tell them, if we look at your project through the five pillars, we can see here you are complying, here you are not complying, and this is how you could comply. And one example is in this specific bus park, they had not thought about how would somebody on a wheelchair access it. And it was a simple issue of providing a ramp that connects from the main road into the bus park, but also around where the people would be walking so that it slopes. It was a small, you can call it a small design issue, but still a big blind spot.
Very crucial design.
Very crucial, yeah. And they were able to rectify this at no great cost to themselves. And this is the way we start to show government it's possible to make progressive changes along the way towards a socially just public transport.
Just so that the listener has an idea, what is public transportation like in Nairobi? Is it mostly based on vans or private vans that take people everywhere? How does it work?
Yeah, first of all, it's good to know in the context of Nairobi, 60% of people walk or cycle to work. So public transport caters to about, let's say, 20-something, 28 or thereabout. It's provided by what we call matatu. Matatu means a private van or a private minibus that has been modified to carry passengers, sometimes more than the recommended manufacturer's capacity. And it's very chaotic because it's private individuals who own these buses or minivans, but they are not the ones who operate. So they outsource these operations to what we could call like collective societies. Or SACOs. And these SACOs are the ones that manage on their behalf, hand over the profits at the end of the month. And then you have a third layer of regulation by the local authorities. And this has made public transport chaotic in Kenya because there is a lack of accountability in the chain from the owner to the regulator because they don't have a direct relationship. And therefore, it remains a chaotic, profit-driven sector. that's not serving the needs of the people of the fully. Yeah.
And I think the work of FES is really commendable, and I think it's just amazing how you use the concept of the Just City in a very applied way, in a very practical way, and you derive results. Do you think it's actually something that we could extend to other countries in Africa? They're all, of course, countries in Africa are incredibly different from one another, but are there commonalities that you think could work?
Yeah, Kenya was the sort of guinea pig to try out the Just City concept. We have since extended it to 10 of our other offices in 10 African countries, trying to balance between the West, South, and the East, because the FES in Africa has a sub-Saharan department and a Middle East and North Africa department. So in the sub-Saharan context, we've tried. Yes, political contexts sometimes differ. Some countries are a bit more advanced, like South Africa, for example, in public transport. But what we find as a commonality is the aspect of investment in provision to and access to public goods and services. This is because a lot of the urban areas in these African countries were founded by the colonial forces. And after post-colonial, there has been a downward spiral in terms of provision of public goods and services. Yet there has been a rapid increase in rural to urban migration. So all the initial plans made in the 60s, 70s, even by post-colonial governments, are not adequate or could not foresee the demands and the population challenge they are facing now. So this commonality is what enables us to be able to discuss issues like public transport, cross-border, cross-country, because we face similar challenges. But apart from that, being a concept that was borrowed from the global north, to say, and is being applied to the global south, we also think there is an opportunity to share the global south lessons with the global north, even where contexts are very, very different, because urbanization is increasingly rapid everywhere, both in the south and the north, and these challenges of how to provide for people a better and just city will continue.
Yeah, and there are common challenges, right, yeah, that we have to face. Mm. Well, just to finish, would you have a final message to our listeners, or to our students also? For the listeners, we are organizing a big summer school, and Titus is one of our guests. What's your final message to these young people listening to us?
Yeah, I have two main messages. And the first one is, when you are planning for cities, don't just be confined to the built environment only. Think about the human you are planning for, and try to go and plan with them. Get to know them, get to know their aspirations and their needs, so that with your expertise, you can bridge their needs to the built environment. Don't forget the nature. You know, the environment, it can be built, but we also have the natural environment. And also you have to understand how do you work with it. So have the human and the natural environment in mind as you design and build, and as you design the built environment. And the second message is to encourage peer exchange and learning. Platforms like the Just City Summer School are an example of how you can do this. It's important that they get out of their comfort zone, out of their trusted communities, in their experts and maybe other close allies, to engage those they wouldn't consider as traditional allies or people with similar interests, and just have a dialogue and exchange. And there is a lot of learning to be found there for more sustainable solutions.
Well, we couldn't hope for a better last message to our listeners. Titus, on behalf of the TU Delft and on behalf of the Summer School and on behalf of our podcast, Duty of Care, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Hi there. Don't miss out on our updates. Subscribe to our mailing list at the Center for the Just City website, www.just-city.org. See you next time.